The Association of Classical and Christian Schools presents Repairing the Ruins, the 2017 ACCS Annual Conference, copyright 2017. You may make additional copies of this recording for use by your school, but please do not sell any copies of the recording. Learn more about classical Christian education and the ACCS at classicalchristian.org.
Well, good afternoon, everybody. My name is Bruce Etter. I'm the head of school for Wilson Hill Academy. Come on in, folks. Come on in. I'm the head of school for Wilson Hill Academy. I hate the term online school. The only term I hate more than online school is virtual school. We're virtually a school if we just keep trying. Maybe we'll eventually be one. We are an online school. I prefer the word omnipresent. We are an omnipresent school. We are everywhere. We are. We are all over the world. Our teachers are all over the world. We're sort of based in Austin, Texas, but we are not an online school. We're not a virtual school. We're an omnipresent school. So, welcome, everybody, to Pedagogical Lessons from Fyodor Dostoevsky. I'm just kind of curious. I've already met one big Dostoevsky fanboy over here. Any other Dostoevsky fans? Just big fans. All right. Anybody have their Dostoevsky ties? Anybody? I promise you that is not a chia pet. One of my students just gave me this, and my teachers and I have been trying to figure out what it is, but we think it's supposed to be Fyodor Dostoevsky. So, on the count of three, tell me what your favorite Dostoevsky novel is. One, two, three. I thought I'd hear a lot of Crime and Punishment. And Eric, what is your favorite? This, A Raw Youth. I've never heard anyone say that was their favorite. But anyway, I'm glad that you're here. Even if you don't know who Dostoevsky is and just came maybe to figure out how to pronounce it, I don't have a clue who he is. I just thought it sounded like a cool name for a talk. Just kidding. Before I begin, I'm going to be talking about worldviews. I'm going to be talking about positions on certain controversial worldviews that we have. And so I want to ask you guys to help me out on this. So I promise you, I am going to be calling on you in about 10 or 15 minutes. So you better scribble something down. What I want you to do is I want you to scribble down, and this is abbreviated form here, folks. Abbreviated form. I'm not looking for long arguments. I'm talking about something you could say and shout out in a few words, and we would kind of know what you mean and what the argument would be there. So it would be the very best arguments that you can think of for the following: homosexuality. So just think about that. What do you think are the very strongest arguments in favor of a homosexual lifestyle? Feminism. It's the second one we're going to go over. Socialism. And forgive me, I'm going to be using terms like communism and socialism a bit interchangeably. I know they're not exactly the same, but just bear with me. So homosexuality, feminism, socialism. And I've got two more. Atheism. So I'm going to ask you, I'm going to call on you. I promise you, I'm going to be calling on you. So have something ready. And then finally, evolution. Evolution. So have those ready, and we'll get to those all in good time. Fyodor Dostoevsky. Some of you probably know a lot about him. We teach a course on Fyodor Dostoevsky at Wilson Hill Academy. I'm blessed to have a boss standing over here in the doorway, Nancy Donaldson, who allowed me, and you wish you had a boss like this, allows me to teach an entire year-long course on the life and works of Fyodor Dostoevsky. We spend the entire year focusing on Dostoevsky, but obviously studying some other Russian history and literature along with it. So that's basically a dream come true for me. Fyodor Dostoevsky was born in 1821 in Moscow, Russia, not Idaho, and died in 1881. He was raised in a Christian environment. His father in particular wanted to make sure that young Fyodor and his brother who would really end up becoming his best friend, Mikael, knew the scriptures well. He wanted his boys to be raised in a Christian home. Dad was a bit strict, though. And when Fyodor was in his 20s, he came into contact with a group of young intellectuals who were much more hip and cool than Dad. And to use a term that my 19-year-old son uses, this group was woke. That is, they were aware of the social justice issues of their day, and they were going to change the world. Well, the problem was, this group of young intellectuals was deemed anti-Tsarist. And under the rule of Tsar Nicholas I, the group was broken up. And in 1849, the 28-year-old Fyodor Dostoevsky was arrested and sentenced to death, 28 years old. As you, most of you probably know, that death sentence was commuted. He ended up spending time in the labor camps of Siberia. Now, there's a bit of controversy over this, and I'm not going to get into it here, but whatever Dostoevsky was before his time in Siberia, we do know that his outlook changed drastically due to his time of imprisonment. Sort of reminds me of the Aeneid. Any Aeneid fans in here? I know we got to have some Aeneid fans. So you remember in the Aeneid, in book 6, where Aeneas goes into the underworld to visit his father. His father gives him the message of what his destiny is really supposed to be. Before that, you see him fumbling and bumbling about and flirting with Carthaginian women. And after that, he has this new, renewed focus of what his vision is to be in founding the new Troy. I kind of see Dostoevsky like that a little bit. He emerges from his suffering in Siberia, having renewed his faith there, and now he's ready to focus on his destiny, and that is preserving the Christian faith, which had characterized the Russian people for so long. Now, you may ask, wow, Russian Orthodoxy goes back to the 10th century. What are you talking about? Why did Christianity in Russia need to be salvaged or saved or preserved in the 19th century? Well, Enlightenment ideals, having transformed the European philosophical landscape, were now slowly but surely creeping into Russia. If you sort of think of worldview issues, whatever came to Russia, whatever came to Europe kind of floated over to Russia about a half a century to a century later. So Russia kind of, you know, in the last several hundred years gets everything a little bit later than everybody else. So if you think Enlightenment, I know you're thinking, wait, that's the wrong century, but no, this is Russia. So now these Enlightenment ideals are floating into Russia. Dostoevsky's post-imprisonment novels are attacking that rationalism, nihilism, and atheism of these new intellectuals. In 1860s, Russia saw a number, honestly, of literary works seeking to add another voice to the mix. Some of you may be familiar with authors like Turgenev, Chernyshevsky, any Tolstoy fans in the crowd. There you go, a few Tolstoy fans. And a few other authors, along with Dostoevsky, who were seeking to influence the direction of Russian faith and culture. It's really striking to me, honestly, how similar 1860s Russia is to our cultural climate today. You think of issues of social justice, big on the radar today. Social justice, the role of women, the question of atheism are sort of at the forefront of public discourse. So Dostoevsky's mission was to call Russia back to faith in that environment. So that's the context. It reminds me of a conversation that Dmitri has with Alyosha in The Brothers Karamazov. Dmitri says to him, "Here the devil is struggling with God and the battlefield is the human heart." Much like you and I see ourselves as being involved in classical and Christian education because we care deeply about the heart and soul of our culture, Dostoevsky was fighting for the future of the Russian soul. So right here at the beginning of my talk, Pedagogical Lessons from Fyodor Dostoevsky, I just kind of want to establish some of the similarities between 1860s, 1870s Russia and ours today. So the question is, how did this brilliant Russian author, this great Russian thinker, Fyodor Dostoevsky, how did he address it? Well, my first example, I want to refer to his crowning achievement. Sorry, Eric, my apologies, please. Certainly one of the greatest novels, I believe, written by any author in any time, The Brothers Karamazov. I'm sure most of you have read it. As with other novels, it's sort of a worldview novel. I like to use that term, a worldview novel. That is, he uses different characters in the novel to represent different worldviews, different perspectives. And then as you follow that character throughout the story, you're seeing where does that person's life end up? And as Dostoevsky's basically saying, that's where that worldview goes. Take a look at that. Is that really where you want to go? Does this remind you, of anybody in the late 20th century? Labrie? I mean, isn't that really essentially what Francis Schaeffer was doing? You know, get in the worldview car, see where it goes. I'm going to show you what the logical end of that worldview is. So maybe you don't want to keep going that way. So I see a lot of similarities, honestly, with what Francis Schaeffer was saying. But anyway. So Alyosha, of course, having been mentored by Father Zosima, he represents the Christian perspective in Brothers Karamazov. Dmitri is the hedonist, but he comes around in the end. And then really some of the most fascinating dialogue in the novel, as you know, are the conversations that take place between Alyosha and Ivan, who is the what? The atheist. Somebody said it. Yes, Ivan represents the atheist worldview. So you're looking at the arguments and you're examining where does Ivan's life end up? Therefore, where does his worldview really go? So in Dostoevsky's mind, the best way to respond to atheism and to prepare Russia's youth to stand against it was to place before them the strongest arguments in favor of that worldview, and then give the Christian response to that atheist. The end result, apparently, was that Dostoevsky's portrayal of atheism was a bit too powerful. Yeah, you know, have you ever thought about the question, is it possible to play devil's advocate too well? Is it possible to play devil's advocate too well? Well, apparently Dostoevsky did, because some of the early critics, literary critics, after they read Brothers Karamazov, after it first came out, they actually thought that he was advocating for the atheist position. And of course, he responded with some choice words that, if I translated them correctly here, probably wouldn't be appropriate to read in this environment. He's like, you guys missed it totally. So they thought that's how strongly he advocates for the position that he wants the youth to avoid. Apparently, Ivan's argument in favor of atheism was pretty convincing. But again, Dostoevsky knew what he was doing. He knew he needed to set up the strongest arguments and respond to them. But why? Well, first of all, for the sake of this talk, I'm going to coin a new term today. That's right. You chose the right talk to come to. We'll make it plural. We're going to make history, friends. We're going to coin a new term right here, right now. Somebody needs to record. Carol, can you record this? Okay. We are coining a new term. I Googled it. As far as I know, this is a new term. No one else has used it. Is everybody seated? Okay. Here we go. I'm not playing games. The new term I'm coining right now before your eyes. Go. I'm calling it the Dostoevsky principle. No, just I don't have time for applause because I got to get through the talk. But I'm calling it the Dostoevsky principle. Now, if you want to sound even nerdier, you can call it the DP. Or you can do the hand motions. The DP. It actually has hand motions. So that's how serious. I told you I wasn't playing a game. Sort of reminds me of seventh grade. What is the Dostoevsky principle? Let me give you an illustration from seventh grade. I don't know if you guys love seventh grade as much as I did. Yeah, I know. Wasn't that great? But I remember the toughest, meanest, orneriest guy in Central Junior High School in Bluefield, West Virginia, was a 6-foot-tall eighth grader named Cortez Martin. That is not Cortez Martin. That is the Russian dude that Rocky beat up. But you get the picture. Cortez Martin was greatly feared. There was a new kid that came to the school in the middle of the school year. His name was Jack Lilly. Remember all this so vividly. I'm scarred deeply by it. I suppose that when Jack came to the school, he felt the need to make his presence known. Now, Jack Lilly was not the sharpest tool in the shed, but he did know one thing. The easiest way to make his presence known, you know what's coming, don't you? What's he going to have to do? He's going to have to beat up Cortez. If he can beat up Cortez, then he will establish himself as the dominant one, which he did in the gym locker room, seventh period one day. I was sitting on a bench in a corner, shaking like a leaf, hoping I wouldn't be next. But you know what? Based on what I'm trying to get at here with the Dostoevsky principle, I was totally safe. Why? Why was I totally safe? Beating me up would prove nothing. That would get you no street cred at all. Nobody cared about beating up scrawny little Bruce Etter. I was scrawny at one point in my life. I know what some of you are thinking there. Beating up Cortez Martin, that was the real prize. And Jack Lilly knew that. Beat up the toughest guy, there'd be no question about his dominance. Now, what does that have to do with the Dostoevsky principle? Dostoevsky wanted to interact with the Cortez Martin version of atheism because he knew that if he refuted that argument, that these young intellectuals going off to the universities, and this was really the big deal, it's really not unlike what we're seeing today. The kids were going off to the Russian universities and they were coming back home telling their parents, we're atheists now because that's cool and that's hip and that's more intelligent. And mom and dad, sorry, you just don't know any better. That was exactly what was happening in Russia in the 19th century. So he knew, Dostoevsky knew he had to go after Cortez. But I fear that in some of our schools, we're beating up on Bruce Etter. We're beating up on the nerdy kid instead of going after Cortez. We're beating up on the nerdy kid and then claiming dominance. What do I mean by that? Well, I think we need to be careful about presenting straw man versions of the worldviews that we're trying to refute and avoid. I've got another term. I'm not sure if this one's going to rise to the level of being a new coined term today, but I call it sparring with grandma. Yeah, look at that. She's ready to go. And I don't know that I would mess with her in my current state of health. But look, if you want to become a great boxer, you spar with the best that you can, right? You spar with the best that you can. You don't spar with grandma. You spar with grandma, and then you get into the ring, and you get destroyed. In some ways, we're sparring with grandma in terms of how we set up the opponents to the worldviews that we espouse in our teaching. We beat up on grandma. We train our students to beat up on grandma instead of Cortez Martin, and then they go out into the world and they're not ready for the Cortez Martin version of the worldview. And then they, in many cases, they toss it all away. Now, since this is breaking news here, pretty sure the news folks will be on the way soon. We need to make it all official, right? So we do need an official definition of the DP, the Dostoevsky principle. And this is, you can look it up. This is actually from the New Bruce Etter Non-Oxford Dictionary. Okay, it's on a PowerPoint slide, so it's official. Here is the definition. Also known as the Cortez Martin principle, also often referred to as the not sparring with grandma principle, It is the practice of arming your students with the ability to effectively respond to non-Christian worldviews by doing what? By placing before them the most cogent, persuasive version of those worldviews and purposefully avoiding straw man expressions of those worldviews. One more time. Arming your students with the ability to effectively respond to non-Christian worldviews by placing before them the most cogent and persuasive versions of these worldviews. Avoiding straw man arguments. The DP would then require that you present your students with the most attractive expression of unbiblical philosophies in an effort to ensure that they don't actually end up embracing that philosophy. So, having laid that groundwork a little bit, my guess is most of you are going to be on board with me at this point. Let's take a look at some specifics. Arguments for homosexuality, feminism, socialism, atheism, and evolution. Now, let me give a little disclaimer here. Let me sort of state the obvious. I realize that in a crowd like this, we don't all agree on these issues. I get that. You may even take one of these labels and say, well, I am that. That's fine. I don't care. That's not really the point of my talk. The point isn't that these are necessarily the greatest evils we face. Maybe they are, maybe they're not. I'm just using these as examples because they are current topics of relevance, and I think that we would generally agree that these are not consistent with the Christian worldview that we're seeking to impart. So, let's start with homosexuality. How would the Dostoevsky principle apply when you're dealing with this one? How many of you have been in a class and you've had to confront the issue of why homosexuality is wrong? Okay, that's a pretty big chunk of you. If you're teaching high school kids, I don't see how in the world you could avoid it. I don't care if you're teaching math. I mean, how do you avoid that? It's a big issue. How would it apply? Recent Pew Research poll had the percentage of Protestant millennials who believe homosexuality is an acceptable lifestyle at around 51%. Now, that's Protestant millennials. I'm suspicious of every statistic I read everywhere. I have no idea if that's right. That number was not actually that shocking to me. I'll tell you what was a bit more disturbing to me, was not that number. But the more disturbing thing is how rapidly that number is going up. That was a little bit more concerning to me. The media, let's just face it, friends. The media has done a brilliant job over the last 30 years of making us sympathetic to homosexuality. Fine. Bring in the most likable, sympathetic example that you can. Make sure that your students know that many homosexual couples live monogamous lifestyles. Bring in the most philanthropic, polite, funny, warm examples of folks living that lifestyle and then confront it. Put before them the most sympathetic examples that you can. Don't tell your students that all homosexuals are flaming, left-wing, profligate weirdos. Don't spar with grandma. Go for the Cortez Martin version of refuting that lifestyle. So I asked you guys earlier, I gave you an assignment. What do you guys think are some of, just, you know, in kind of shotgun responses, some of the strongest arguments in favor of homosexuality as being an acceptable lifestyle? You can just shout them out. Jesus doesn't address it. The genetics. How can you say otherwise they're born that way? They love each other and they're living a monogamous lifestyle. David and Jonathan were definitely gay. That was facetious, guys. It's like that's going to end up, someone's going to cut that out of the recording. Well, obviously, Etter can't speak next year because this is what we get from him. Okay, you see what I'm saying? Those are the arguments you have to address. Not the sparring with grandma, not the easy stuff. It's easy to do that because you're there in the room and you're the only adult And you can look really cool and tough and smart by throwing out the easy arguments. But it's a lot harder because you may have to actually say, and I've done this many times, you may actually have to say, good grief, that's a good argument. I don't know. I'm going to have to think about it. That's not the end of the world. But it's better that you wrestle through the very, very, very toughest arguments with them. Okay. I think a lot of times on the homosexuality issue, I think we forget, you know, that it's about the nature of the gospel. It's about husband and wife. It's about Christ and the church. And so we come up with all these other reasons, and I don't know all the time that we get really to the heart and soul of what gender. But anyway, don't set your students up to leave your school only to come to the realization later on when they go to college that, well, look at that. I've got these homosexual friends, and they're actually very nice people. They're very nice people. They're not the demonic description that my Christian high school teacher gave me. Not the straw man. And then what have you done, though? What have you done when you beat up on grandma? And they may not necessarily embrace that lifestyle for themselves, but you have then caused them to cast doubt upon not only your authority in that area, but what else? Everything else. They're like, are you kidding me? And they may not use this terminology, but they wake up one day and they realize, we just sparred with grandma throughout my whole high school career. And they come back after a year or two of college and you realize that they've gone left on every issue and you don't know why. Okay, next worldview. Feminism, I know this one's kind of controversial. If you're a Christian feminist, I don't care. That's fine. Let's just kind of assume we're talking about versions of feminism that are most certainly opposed to scriptural teaching. So, what do you got? Men are impressive? I was like, well, I know, but how does that work? Just kidding. Men are definitely oppressive, aren't they, Scott? Except for Scott. Okay, that's good. The Bible has definitely been used to oppress women. I would say most women are capable than most men. Let's just be truthful, guys. Okay, these are good. Yeah. Can you write that one down? That's good. I like that. Okay, but you get my point, right? Did you have another one, ma'am? Oh, the abdication of male authority. Here we go. My daughter's actually coughing at me right now, which means you're listening to that, Dad? So, yes, Sarah, I am. She's my slide flipper. The DP demands that we display feminism as attractively as it might be displayed by the most persuasive representatives of feminism. We need to get onto the table the best arguments for it, not the straw man, not grandma. Again, bring in the most delightful, intelligent, gracious person who offers the best and most articulate version of those arguments you guys have just brought up, and then address it. Equality, dignity. Let's go to socialism. Socialism, I think we need to be a little bit careful with this one. I think this might be one of the easiest ones to cherry pick. If you know what I mean by cherry picking, just kind of hit for the low-hanging fruit, just kind of hit below the belt, the easy shots. And look, I teach courses where we have to deal with socialism, so I've done this myself. We talk about the tens of millions of people who have died as a result of communism. We talk about how it has failed in so many places. We talk about the horrible people like Joseph Stalin and Fidel Castro. We talk about human nature and how communism doesn't work because of what the Bible says about the reality that we are sinners. That's fine. That's good. We talk about the positives of competition and free enterprise. All of that is well and good unless you stop there. You see, the DP would require that you present the doctrines of socialism so strongly that it appears that you are actually arguing in favor of it. That's what happened to Dostoevsky. Honestly, if you have time and you can work it out logistically, ideally, you bring in someone who embraces the view. You've got to bring them into your classroom. And I've done that at different Christian schools where I've taught, and that was controversial. There were faculty, I obviously got permission of the administration to do it, but there were faculty members that had serious problems with that, and we had to talk about it, and we can address that later. But I'm a big proponent of it. Look, you don't think they're going to run into these people on the streets or on university campuses? And you're afraid to bring them into your classroom because this is a Christian school and you don't want to soil your campus? What are you thinking? This is the safe environment. This is the time to do it. Probably understand I'm a little passionate about that one. Anyway, so socialism. What do you got? Hit me with Cortez Martin right hooks.
Capitalists are blood suckers. All they care about is the bottom line.
Of course they are. Enough said. But we'll take a few more. I like it. Oh, they were totally socialist. Yes. Oh, man. That's starting to hurt a little bit. Yeah. Ooh, okay, good. Some of the good things that have actually happened in socialist countries. See, we've kind of got this idea that nothing good has ever happened in any communist country ever at all. That's just not true. And when your students realize it's not true, they will feel betrayed by you. They will feel like you betrayed them. Or you just didn't even know any better yourself. And again, go back to the conclusion we drew earlier. Then what does that do? Cast doubt on everything else. Okay. Equality, classless society. Are we taking care of the poor? There are lots of strong arguments in favor of socialism. Let's go to the last one, atheism. Atheism. How do we spar with grandma on this one? Well, I think, sometimes we quote Psalm 14:1, the fool has said in his heart, there is no God. And that's where I start. When I'm discussing atheism, I start right there. Because that's what the Word of God says very clearly about it. But I don't stop there. Don't misunderstand me. As a Reformed-leaning evangelical, I don't believe that people come to faith in the true and living God through rational arguments. So I'm not trying to make that kind of a case here. In the existence of God. I'm not talking about that. What I am talking about is preparing our students to be able to deal with these ideas after they leave us. So, once again, the DP would require that we present atheism so strongly that it appears as if you are actually in favor of it. If you have time and can work it out, bring an atheist into your classroom. Does that make any of you a little nervous? You can admit it. No? Seriously? I mean, I've talked to a lot of teachers about this, and a lot of teachers get really nervous about that. Bring an atheist into your classroom. Who, now again, even there you have to be careful. Don't bring in some uneducated, inarticulate person and then beat up on that. You're just sparring with grandma in a different way. So bring the strongest and the greatest and the best. You don't have to feel like that there's some kind of display going on, that you have to refute that atheist in front of everybody, or that means there is no God. You don't have to do that. Just bring him in for a healthy discussion. Make some coffee, get some donuts, sit around in a circle. Hear his arguments. Let the students ask questions. You can ask some. Follow up later. But the point is, get the most articulate version of it. So, where are we? This is actually what Dostoevsky does in The Brothers Karamazov. He's not necessarily dealing with the arguments in favor of atheism, but what he's doing is he's dealing with some of the realities that would seem to make belief in God untenable. So he specifically focuses on the suffering of children. That's a big issue. He tells some heart-rending, oh, you will weep. And if you're not weeping, you don't have a heart. He tells some heart-rending stories about the suffering and torture of little children. And then, where was God? Why did you really believe there could be a good God in light of that? So, where are you guys on this one? My daughter, my slide flipper here, was in my Dostoevsky class this past year. And that their end of the year presentation, part of what her group within a group had to do was to present the arguments in favor of atheism. And then the class had to take a vote. I think it ended up being 18-2 in favor of the atheists. So I'm saying to my daughter, what have you done? You have converted my class. But the class really honestly felt like the arguments they gave in favor of atheism were much stronger than the ones that were given in favor of belief in God. Okay, let's go to evolution. I know we all have different views on this, but how do we go after Cortez Martin on this one? I'm sure that some of you know better than I do. But I know that I've read several books written by Richard Dawkins. Anybody read Dawkins' books? I would assume in a crowd like this, a large number. Here's the thing. I'm not convinced that we're graduating students who can even interact on that level, that they could read or hear a speech or read a book written by someone like Dawkins and really give a decent, cogent response to it. When you read Dawkins' books, I think that you'll see that not only is that the case, but we're not actually addressing the evidence he offers. We're using other arguments that are not even the ones that he's addressing. And then when he responds, he tends to say, well, you know, you're using arguments that are at least 20 or 30 years old. We're just not there anymore. And then the Christian community is looked upon without any kind of credibility. We're sort of talking over and under and around each other on this one. I don't even think we're on the same page. And I, you know, last couple of years, I read a bunch of Dawkins' books, and I realized we're not even talking about the same stuff. And we keep using these sort of canned reasons and issues for why you either believe in evolution or why you believe in a young earth. And those are not the issues that they're even discussing. So on this one, it's actually a little bit worse. So you guys, you tell me. I don't know, maybe we should require students to read The God Delusion or The Selfish Gene. Have you ever done that? Have you ever had your students read a Dawkins book? Okay, so what do you guys think about this one? Strongest arguments? Favor of? X-Men. I don't even know if we need to move on. Wow. Anybody want to give a lesser argument? Yes. Say that again. Yes, very good. Junk DNA. Any others? Fossil record. Yes. Okay. Okay. In the back. Oh, ooh. Now see, that's one that's used to beat up a lot of folks with. Yeah, I mean, I just suggest that you read some of Dawkins' books. I don't know, there are probably others, Sam Harris. But again, I think you'll see what I mean if you read one or two of those books. We're just not even talking about the same things. So let me just pause here before I move on to some other things and give a word, as if I haven't already done it, in favor of guest speakers. A few years ago, I taught a world religions class to high school students. We covered all the major faiths of the world. Then we kind of got into the pseudo-Christian cults. So I would bring in a practicing member of each one of those faiths. So we had Judaism, Hinduism, Buddhism, Islam, and then we did some of the pseudo-Christian cults like LDS, Jehovah's Witnesses, Christian Science, Hare Krishna, and so forth. So at that time, I was teaching at Veritas Academy under Ty Fisher. Some of you know Ty. And if you know Ty, this might be slightly more enjoyable. But I'll never forget the nervous looks on Ty's face every day when a new visitor would come through the front doors. Because as you can imagine, they didn't look like us. And coming to the classroom, Ty called it the freak show, and he was very nervous about it. He was always afraid he was going to get some kind of phone call from a parent, and the school was going to be shut down. But the point was to make sure that the students heard from them, not me. I could certainly give them an overview of each of those faiths, sure. But there's nothing like getting it straight from a practicing member of that religion. And I'll be honest, it was controversial. It really was. When I did the same thing at another school in Virginia, there were teachers, as I said, who voiced opposition to it. We're a Christian school. That's the very thing we're trying to guard against and avoid. And yet at the same time, what I didn't understand is that I would ask the same teachers, what are you reading in your literature classes? Oh, we're reading Karl Marx and Hitler, and we're reading Plato. I'm like, oh, they're not that bad. I mean, it's like, so really, I don't think there's a logical thinking on that. But anyway, the deal was the very reason that they wanted to avoid those kinds of things. It didn't make sense to me. They were bound to encounter these faiths eventually. And why not encounter them now under my tutelage? So the structure that I used for that is, first of all, I would lay the groundwork in class before the speaker came. So we would talk about Buddhism, maybe read a few primary sources if we could, that kind of thing. Then bring in the speaker, Q&A, always very polite. It was never gotcha. It was never, I'm going to railroad you, I'm bringing you in. They were always scared to come. For every single speaker, I had to convince them, I'm not bringing you in to beat you up. It's a Christian school of that. I know it is. You might get beat up in another class. I can't promise anything that we're not going to beat you up. We would always then follow up with a discussion after the talk, and we always sent a thank you card, trying to develop a relationship with that person. Now, as an aside, not really wanting to focus on this here, but as an aside, I think it's a great idea to do this in other areas where you have differences of opinion within your school. Why not do the same thing with infant baptism? Look, I mean, if you really want your kids to figure out what they believe about baptism, then get the very, very, very strongest arguments out there in favor of infant baptism and the very strongest arguments against it, and then talk and discuss and debate. Bring in a Presbyterian one day and a Baptist pastor the next, or bring them in at the same time, and then have them discuss it and debate it. All right, I want to shift gears a little bit and consider two other issues. Our time's going to be running out soon. In each of these areas, there are those who would say that the worldview, so it's not only that you're fighting against a worldview that you don't want your students to hold. In many cases, what's going to happen is that you're going to have to sort of fight against the idea of folks who would say that worldview is actually biblical. That is some of you kind of brought that out in your responses. Isn't that what we're hearing from some of our graduates now? Teacher, Mr. or Mrs. Teacher, I've learned that socialism is actually a biblical concept. Why didn't you teach me that? I've discovered that the Bible actually teaches that homosexuality is a perfectly acceptable lifestyle. I had a book that I was going to show you called The Children Are Free, written by a gay pastor who makes the arguments for homosexuality being entirely and completely biblical. He's a pastor in Chicago, and I'm sorry, I actually wanted to kind of show you the book, but the book is called The Children Are Free, if you're interested in reading it. So again, I read the book because one of my long, 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 long time friends came to me about 7 years ago and laid it all out. He said, Bruce, I'm gay. I just can't hide it anymore. I mean, this guy's a strong believer and all this stuff. And he had read that book. So I read the book, and I wrote the author a long letter trying to engage him, but he would not respond. But I copied my friend so that my friend could see, hey, look, I'm trying to spar with Cortez here. You're telling me that's the strongest arguments. And here would be a response to that. Okay, where are we? Second issue, dying on the wrong hills. Oh, friends, do we not do this on occasion in our classes? Dying on the wrong hills. I want you to think of a table. I think I have an image a table. It's kind of a quick, no, it's next. Kind of a quick switch there. Now, let's just say that you have a table. Yeah, there it is. There, we'll get to that. Let's just say that you have a table that is a standard four-legged table, just your basic table. All four legs are necessary to hold it up. But let's just say that aesthetically you're not happy with that four-legged table, and you want to add legs to the table because you just like table legs. They're not necessarily holding the table up, but you think they look really nice. Don't we do that in our teaching sometimes? I think it can be really dangerous. We have some sort of pet theological issue and something we really, really like, and we communicate to our students, knowingly or unknowingly, that this issue is actually vital to the Christian faith. And the Christian faith cannot stand without this leg or that leg, when that's really not the case. The problem is, when that particular leg is pulled out from underneath the table, we know that the table still stands. But we've communicated to our students that the table's going to fall without that leg. Let me give you an example. And I'm just going to apologize ahead of time. I know I'm probably going to step on some toes here. It's probably Scott's fault. But I like to think of the age of the earth issue as fitting into this category. And I know some of you just disagree with me on that. Come by my booth. I'll give you a screen cleaner. And we can chat about it. But here's what I see. A teacher who has a very strong opinion that the earth is young, let's say 6 to 10,000 years old. The teacher is convinced that the Bible teaches that the earth is young, and therefore the Christian faith does what? The Christian faith now does what? Stands or falls based upon the issue of the age of the earth? Now, friends, can you see how absurd that is? Do you see how you've set your student up to fall on his or her face? What happens then when they start hearing strong arguments that the earth is not young? What you've told them is what? The Bible then is not reliable, so everything falls. We're dying on the wrong hills, guys. I understand. I've got my pet theological issues too. And we can preach those and we can teach those, but we got to make sure that we don't make them additional legs underneath the table in how we communicate them. Student goes off to the university, hears that the earth is not young, and now the question is not whether or not the earth is old or young. The question is whether or not the Christian faith stands or falls on that particular issue. So in the end, I think honestly, we've probably done more damage than not addressing the issue at all. It would have been better to just not do anything in that particular area. We can't choose the wrong hills to die on. The resurrection of Christ? Amen. Die on that hill. Yes. The incarnation? Absolutely. A particular view of creation? I'm not going to die on that hill. But I think if you are, you're setting your students up for a difficult situation. Age of the earth. Whether or not Mark or Matthew was written first? Mark in priority. No, it's not a table leg, is it? Important, but not a table leg. These are extra legs under the table. Students go away thinking that it was a hill to die on, but it is not. All right, a variation on this. How are we doing on time? Oh, we need to stop soon. Okay. A variation on this theme. Overstating the case. Overstating the case. You know what I mean? No communist countries have ever had any success doing anything at all. Ever. None. Not one. Not one communist dictator has ever done, said, or thought a good thought ever in the history of the world, which is young. That was not in my script. I just made that up. So you understand that you're overstating the case. Now, I know sometimes, folks, we get carried away, don't we? We get passionate in our class, and we're beating up on grandma's, maybe it's Cortez, but we get excited, and the emotion comes, and then we say things like that. I've done that. But you got to be careful. Overstating the case is kind of a variation on the theme of adding legs underneath the table. It's just not true. And when they realize it's not true, it's going to cast doubt on everything else that you've taught. But it's tempting. It's very, very tempting. Oh, goodness gracious. Okay, let's wrap things up. Yeah, you guys are looking like you've had enough of me. Time to wrap things up. There's another interesting, let me go back to Dostoevsky, another interesting connection between Dostoevsky and his world and what you and I think, are trying to attempt today. As I said earlier, Dostoevsky was greatly disturbed by the rationalism and the atheism of his day, and he believed that it was threatening Russia's longtime commitment to the Christian faith. And he believed that that Christian faith of the Russian people. Now, check this out. If you don't know much about Dostoevsky, this is pretty fascinating stuff. Dostoevsky believed that the Christian faith of the Russian people could serve as a city on a hill, a bright and radiant light of the truth of the gospel that would shine, get this, that would shine over there into the darkness of European Enlightenment thinking. Isn't that interesting? As American citizens, wait a second, we're the light on a hill, right? We're the city on a hill. Not according to Dostoevsky. At that point, the Western world had kind of gone the way of the Enlightenment. And in his mind, it was actually going to have to be Russia who was going to, through the faith of its people, and it was the intellectuals that he's addressing, because he knew, he understood trickle-down philosophy, but it was going to have to be through the faith of the Russian people that would shine over into previously lit up Europe, but now dark Enlightenment Europe. He wanted to call them back. He looked to the enlightened West, and he saw a failure to maintain the Christian faith. And he believed that the Russian faith would call him back. Now, you and I are involved in classical Christian education for various reasons. But I would say, I mean, I know the income is a big part of it. Just making sure you're awake. I like that. That was like a delayed, oh, that's good. Yeah, just making sure you guys are awake. Lunch is on the way, guys. We're almost there. You and I are involved in classical Christian education for various reasons, but one of the reasons that I would say that we agree on is that we see around us a culture that is in a tailspin, a culture that has long given up on objective truth, a culture that is very confused and doesn't really even know what it believes or if any belief is even possible at all. But just as concerning to us is the number of youth leaving the church after they finish up with us in high school. I have no idea how to get the most accurate numbers on this. I tried. Everybody has a different one. But I did look at various sources, and the lowest I found, I don't know, you guys tell me if this sounds disturbingly high. The lowest I found was 60%, and it was usually 75. That's hurtful, isn't it? That is shocking, that are leaving the faith, that after they leave your doors, of the walls of your Christian school, there's a 3 in 4 chance, according to that, that they're just going to toss it all. Now, what I also know, because I'm older than some of you, is that some of them do come back. Okay, a bunch of them actually do come back. But the reality is, that's disturbing. That's kind of not the model. That's not the ideal. Even though they come back, we kind of don't want them to leave. If you're like me, you see classical and Christian education as the strongest response to the growing popularity of non-biblical ideas and the strongest response to the assault on our faith in various ways. We have to be in the business of giving the students the tools of learning so that they own. That is so important, isn't it, teachers? So that they own what we are passing on to them. Much as Dostoevsky saw Russia as that city on a hill in the 19th century, let's pray that God will use our schools as lights in darkness. I hope that my ramblings today have about Dostoevsky and the Dostoevsky principle will help us to do justice to the words of Peter. And I know these are very familiar words to you. Peter says that we should sanctify the Lord God in our hearts and always be ready to give a defense to everyone who asks you a reason for the hope that is in you with meekness and fear. And I hope that the Dostoevsky principle will help us in some ways to that end. Thank you for coming and thank you for listening.